WMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
Zero, the land, conservative world at its best. Tolls, and of course more tolls to get here to Atlantic City. But we're here to talk to our friends at the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, who are holding their Joint Council 53 annual meeting. And like last week when we were in Las Vegas talking to our IBEW friends, we're getting the word out, getting out of the studio, talking to their representatives. So we're looking forward to the next 2 days. We're going to be here today and tomorrow, back in the studio live on Wednesday. Also going to talk about the 60 Minutes piece. Interesting report they had last night. We're going to be talking about the Romney plan for the nation, or the lack of a... Also going to talk about voter suppression, which front and center. Several studies out, several new ones pointing out what we've been talking about for the longest time. Who's being affected by this? Well, of course, it's the minorities. It's or it's the seniors. It is exactly the folks that they want to hold from voting. Also goes, well, Granny booed him. I mean, what do you got to do for Granny to boo you at the AARP National Annual Conference there in New Orleans? Well, the comments over Medicare. I mean, front and center, this is a guy that I think seniors get. They get it on a fundamental level that this guy wants to destroy Medicare, wants to, well, privatize it, voucherize it, whatever you want to call it. That's the goal. We're seeing the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Some more reports and more studies to tell us that, yeah, there's a problem. I guess we already knew that. But the question then becomes, who's going to make this situation better? Is it going to be Barack Obama? Will it be Mittens? Or is the situation, as some have told me, hopeless? Because both parties are controlled, bought, and paid for by the wealth class. And until we do something about money and politics, until we do something about the Koch brothers, until we do something about the wealth class, it's going to be business as usual. Also, going to do, with your thoughts, you can email me, Rick, at the Rick Smith. As always, you can email me. I do respond to every email. Persons that, you know, total stimulus, total, man, well, it's all about undoing the last 40 years of hand everything to the few at the expense of the many. And this weekend, on Saturday, we showed up in Philadelphia for a voter ID rally. And what it really was more than a rally. It was more getting people out in the streets, getting folks knocking on doors and leafleting and talking to voters and, of course, registering voters. You talk about numbers. You talk about, well, you know, we know that, you know, this segment of the population, they're going to be suppressed in this vote. We know that. The studies are there, the information is there, but until you actually look into the eyes of somebody, until you actually see them and communicate and say, you know what, your vote is being suppressed from, it's being taken away. And for them to go, well, I didn't know, I hadn't heard. And to say, but I voted every election my entire life, why now? And that's the question, why now? Because I do believe the Republicans understand that if they can hold down the vote, if they can suppress the minorities, the poor, the elderly. If you can hold those votes down, votes of people who generally look to government for help. Just for help. Not a handout, for help. Those are people who generally vote for Democrats. And you know the rhetoric that's been coming out this, especially the last week since the Romney video. Well, you know, the 47%, you know, they're dependent. No, these are people who understand that we're all in this together. But it was a great event in Philadelphia. The Pennsylvania AFL-CIO had their RV there. Arlene Holt Baker, an executive vice president with the national AFL-CIO, was on hand. There were hundreds of volunteers, you know, and just swarms of people. And we got some pictures up at our Facebook page, you know, and I look at this and you see all of these folks who are just ready to go in and register. And you talk to the people who work at the driver's license bureau, the PennDOT bureau, and you know they're like, you know, we're just overwhelmed. You know, they've thrown out these mandates with very little training, with very little direction. In fact, you know, it wasn't too long ago when they said, well, we're going to give those frontline workers the discretion to give voter IDs or not if they don't have the exact stuff. So we're going to give them discretion. And I said on this program, that is a horrible idea. Because, you know, if I'm the worker, if I'm the person on the front line, I'm going to go, whoa, 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 you know, I'm going to protect my behind. And they bet on that. But, you know, the event this weekend, I talked to a whole bunch of people, veterans, you know, women, you name it. We saw people who could not believe that the Republicans in this state are going this far. And, you know, one of the weird things that I came back and, you know, the organizers of the event had T-shirts. And I got one for my daughter, who's 10. And, you know, she's showing some interest in politics. And I gave it to her. And the shirt said, my right, my vote. And, you know, basically just to protect your rights, protect your vote. And she, you know, she asked my wife, who is completely apolitical. She wants nothing to do with it. She, you know, she understands on the conceptual level. You know, she gets it. She's going to vote, you know, who's going to be best, you know, for the country and all that. But, you know, in talking about it and doing all that, she wants no part of it. She actually had, and this just, I had to eavesdrop. She actually had like a 20-minute discussion with my daughter about why this election, this one in particular, is so vital, is so vitally important, to, especially her and to my wife, to women especially. And she said, you know, and leave it to my wife to be the good mother, the good parent. You know, didn't get into all of the details. My daughter's 10. You're not going to get into the whole abortion conception. You're not going to get into all of that discussion. But you're going to, she went into, look, you know, we as women have not had the same rights as everyone else from the founding of this country. It has been a constant struggle. And there's a kids movie, that I don't even know which one it is, that my wife watches with the kids, where they're, you know, it's an older movie, and there were women who were marching and you were protesting, and my wife explained that, you know, those are the suffragettes, years or less, have said, you know what? We want the right to vote. We want to be like everybody else. And as my wife pointed out, you know, look, a lot of that's under attack right now. A lot of that movement forward that women of past generation want for. Access to care for their bodies. Political one. She's not the one to go out on the picket line. She's not the one to go out and protest. She's not the one to call her congressman. Any of that stuff. But she gets the assault. She gets the attack. She understands. She's seen it. And it's not because she's married to me, and because we don't usually talk about it. You know, I got this program, this is where I come, but for at least 20 minutes she went on about, you know, why this election, this one in particular, is important for women. Because all of those things that the right has been whispering to themselves in their little cloakrooms and their little secret clubs and their gated communities, now they're emboldened to pursue. Now they're emboldened to go after. They want to go after contraception. They want to go after a woman's right to choose. They want to go after the woman's right to vote. And I guarantee you that's coming. And what's encouraging to me, and I hope it's encouraging to you, is that, you know, someone like my wife, who, again, apolitical, sees this, understands it on a visceral level. This is not something you can advertise for. This isn't something I can come and tell you on the radio to be upset about. You're gonna feel it in your gut, as she does. And that's why I think this election, you know, the Republicans have better watch themselves. because they are working on making themselves the outlier party for some time. I'm anti-Republican because there are some things, that some core tenets that they hold, they used to hold, that I believe in. I believe in your bills. I believe in being personally right there. But this head into is the take this nation back. Be the greatest place in the world for my kids to grow up, my grandchildren, and into the future. Exceptionalism. It's because of, well, we were born here, and it's a birthright because of what our founders gave us and what the past generations gave us. And yeah, that makes us exceptional. But what truly makes us exceptional is every generation makes those sacrifices for the next generation. Every generation goes, you know what? I want to make sure that my kids get the very best education, the very best workplace, the very best, you name it, healthcare, you name it, whatever it is. We want the very best for our kids, as I do believe every person in this world does. But I think what makes this nation exceptional is the decisions that we make, the policies that we pursue to make sure that, you know what, that happens. And this weekend when I was, this past week when I was in Las Vegas talking to the folks at the IBEW, now that's kind of the message that I laid out. Look, this nation is exceptional because of people like me. I grew up in a housing project, and now I live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers, and why is that? What made that happen? Was it because I'm of such strong intestinal fortitude and I have such strong will? Is that the reason? No, not necessarily. It's because we had policy early on in my life that made sure that I got fed. I had a roof over my head. There was an opportunity for education. There's an opportunity card and played by the rules that I would benefit and I would be able to move ahead. That's the America that I want again. That's the America that I want for my children. That's the exceptional place. I want that American dream. I want that ability for them to go, you know what? There is a shot for me. And what's going on is we've got these Republicans who from day one when this president took office saying, we're going to make him fail. We're going to stand in the way. Do what we can do.
Fish are pre-flood fish? Nope. Can't have it both ways. Asadax. Intelligent design. On the other hand, from an evolutionary standpoint, it's quite fascinating, isn't it? Absolutely. Imagine natural selection realizing that something had to take care of the whale carcasses at the bottom of the ocean, or pretty soon the planet would be just nothing but whale carcasses. And so over the course of millennia, epochs, eras, whatever, a little mouthless, eyeless worm evolves to mouthlessly and eyelessly digest the remains of whales at the bottom of the ocean. And on the 25th day of October, in the second decade of the 21st century, ruin a whole lot of people's dinner. Find natural selection much more exciting than some literally nitpicking or nitplacing God. Now, let's see. What am I going to do with the worm? Wait a minute. Wait, did the whales have to start dying when sin entered the world? I don't know. I can't go where these fundies' heads go. I can't make it make sense. Namely, that's because it doesn't. And then, this note from Tom. Tom is a long-time pillar of the community, helping us stay afloat. Tom works in and around boats. That's hence the use of the word afloat. Got a note from Tom today. Subject line, L.A. Dreaming. Oh, dear. And Tracy said, Bob, California is the place you ought to be, so he loaded up the truck and moved to Beverly Hills, that is. Sorry, says Tom, couldn't resist having grown up watching Jed and the Family on the TV box. Oh, I'm a devotee, believe me. You know what we need, Uncle Jed? Motivation. I was just over there on the Brando lot, and they're just swimming in it. Anyway, Tom continues, actually, my sister once attended a classmate's birthday party in the house that used to film the Beverly Hillbillies, the white mansion with the black and white floor inside the front door. It's not really in Beverly Hills, it's in Bel Air. It was one of those things where you had to invite the whole class to be polite. Boy, did they stoop out of their class for that one. Anyway, well, Bob, Tom says, I'm not at all sure you'd like living in the City of the Angels, but I'm sure you'd like to visit, and I would. Tom says, I grew up there, and Tracy's right. The air quality's much better than it was back in the 60s and 70s. I've been back there a couple of times in the last decade or two, and I'd have to say that the air quality downtown now is at least as good as it was in the beach towns back in the 60s. L.A. is an exciting, happening place, and I could live there, I think, but not my first choice. Really, what I wanted to do is write about fundraising, says Tom. I'm pleased and relieved that it's gone well recently, but I have a few suggestions for the future. And I'm sharing this email with you because y'all are the boss. To the extent that this whole volunteer crew here at the Horn has a boss, y'all are them. And so talk amongst yourselves, share your ideas back with me, we'll form some kind of consensus. So, suggestions for the future from Tom. First off, much as I like the widget on the main page, I realize that on the occasions when you've gotten some funding for travel and it shows up on the bar graph, it's a huge disincentive to contribute. Is there any way you can arrange a separate account for those funds so they don't automatically show up on the chart? Well, either that or modify the chart. I don't know. That's one of those things John and I will go over, and John... Well, I'll ask John, and John will have the answer. There's not a much... John's the smart guy on this one. Second. Darn it. I'm getting called out on my math again. Confounded Cyphron and Gazintas. See, I told you I was an old Beverly Hillbillies fan. Second, $2,500 per month doesn't equal $100 a show, Bob. Putting on my micro-business owner hat here, says Tom. There are 20 working days per month, 52 weeks, less 2 weeks you might be off for travel, sick, whatever. That's what you use to pencil it out. So $2,500 divided by 20 equals $125 per show. That's for starts. You know, because I suck at math. Third, and maybe the most important, we really, really, really need, says Tom, build up some financial cushion or contingency funds to fall back on in case of the inevitable funding dry month or equipment failure. Or I'll add paying off the rotating credit account that keeps us in equipment repairs from time to time. Again, these are inevitable. Yes, they are. And so some savings are crucial. To that end, I propose increasing the monthly funding goal to $3,000. That's not me saying that. That's Tom. That would be $150 per show. If we can put aside $500 a month or even $200 a month, eventually there will be a month or two set aside in the bank to ease the stress and ensure the continuance of the Horn. And if we come up a couple of hundred short, we're still putting something aside. No doubt that seems like a daunting amount, but you never get there if you don't try. I still get butterflies in my stomach every time I tell a prospective customer, because Tom runs his own business. I still get butterflies in my stomach every time I tell a prospective customer the price for one of my custom-made goodies, which range from several thousand to maybe $20,000. But, by George, three of them went to the checkbook this week. So I've got 6 weeks more work lined up. Wolf away from the door for a while, and a second C-note for this month coming toward the Horn tomorrow. Peace, says Tom. Thank you, Tom. And I'd read this before, so I knew that he said in P.S., P.S., it's always okay to use my name in conjunction with contributions. So there is an idea worth discussing, and I will leave it to you to think it out and get back and let me know what you think. Meanwhile, back to the rest of the email box. Marty asking, why not aim at the overall list of talk radio and working on passing Dennis Miller at number 5 overall? I'm game for that, are y'all? God, can you imagine what it would be like to have that many internet radio listeners? Why, shucks, the people from Buy Gold Now would probably be beating down our doors. But, Bob, don't you want to hustle gold for us? Oh, if you don't want to hustle the gold, how about vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls, Bob? No? Swedish mattresses made out of NASA's space foam, Bob? Hey, Bob, come on, everybody wants a herbal erection remedy pill. That would be really cool, though. And I get the sense we are growing. I really do. Michael writes in, he says, Hannity and Kincaid. Oh, and I ruined y'all's dinner. Bob, brilliant idea. You just do a couple of years stand on Fox sitting next to Sean. Hannity and Kincaid. Then when you leave and come back to the horn, and I'm sure you'll pull ahead of Combs. I'll bet Alan doesn't have to beg and scrape when a power supply blows. True on both counts. But then again, yeah, I'd wind up on a tabloid somewhere. Crazy liberal tries to strangle Hannity. Musses hair. Yeah, that's what I'd do. You cutie. Just musses perfect hair. You know, he's a life support system for a haircut, Hannity is. Then this from Kate. Talking back to the worms. See, Bob? I've been saying for a long time. We don't worry about those rotten old guys who think they're in control of we girls. We have all the power, and them old guys don't realize that they're in jeopardy. Natural selection. Yeehaw. Rock on. P.S., says Kate, thanks to all who are so dedicated and generous. We have a long ways to go. See, I mean, what a little evolutionary moment of evolutionary control. Now, Emery, you just get in that little sack on my back there and secrete or something or whatever. But watch some football. But secrete until I tell you otherwise. It's all a big facade. Now, it's amazing where my mind goes. I got to thinking, well, I read Dr. John's email yesterday about the Osedaxes. And at the same time, I had actually read a New York Times magazine article, a fascinating article, called The Island Where People Forget to Die. And I would love it if some of the conversation this evening actually turned around this. I think it is. It's truly fascinating. It is about a little Greek island called Ikaria. Ikaria. Where it turns out folks are living into the very healthily into their 90s and a decent number of them up past 100. And I'm not talking about sitting watching reruns of game shows in the rec room of the nursing home. I mean, they're out there planting their gardens, harvesting their gardens, drinking a little wine, sitting in the sun, catching a nap. And scientists are studying these long-lived communities. And this is one of the latest ones to be discovered. Little itsy-bitsy tiny Greek island off the Turkish coast, Ikaria. Not far from Samos, which is an entirely different world. It's at NewYorkTimes.com. the island where people forget to die. That's fascinating. Because way down into the article, one of the people who is doing the studying says, if we can't talk about a silver bullet to longevity, we have to talk about silver buckshot. Because there are a lot of things that play into this, and I don't even know if I can adequately discuss it, except to say that I just read it with a sense of delighted fascination. Not necessarily delighted because people live long lives, but because it seems that they live happy ones. The story turns on the account of a man named Stamatis Moraitis, who, after having been had an arm mangled in World War II combat, wound up in the United States, where he settled in Port Jefferson, New York. There were other folks there from Icaria. Got a job as a laborer, saved his money, eventually did what so many New Yorkers do and moved to Florida. Married an American woman of Greek extraction, had three kids, and as the article notes, bought a three-bedroom house in a 1951 Chevrolet. In 1976, he was diagnosed with lung cancer and told he had 6 months to live. Several doctors confirmed his lung cancer. I'm sorry, they gave him 9 months to live. He was, as the article notes, in his mid-60s. And that is when the call of the native soil began to reverberate in his head. And so he and his wife packed up everything and headed back home to Icaria. He got home, he planted a little garden, didn't expect to ever harvest it, but along the way started eating the local diet and living the local life. And 9 months later, he was still alive. And a year later, he was still alive. And 2 years, and 10 years, and 15 years later. Became a renewed part of the community. Drank a little wine. Ate the local greens. Didn't eat much meat. A little fatted pork every now and then. Goat a little more often. Drank a good bit of goat's milk. Drank teas made seasonally of the local herbs, things like wild mint and fennel and marjoram and something called artemisia. Then he started working on his vineyard. Got the vineyard up and running to the point that it was cranking out about 400 gallons of wine a year. Icaria, Marty, Ikaria. He's still alive. Pushing 100. At one point, he tells the researcher that he did go back once to ask the American doctors why he had survived. And, well, he couldn't get answers from them because they were all dead. There are stories in here of the Mediterranean diet, fish, lots of greens, dandelions. We've talked about dandelion greens. Natural herbs. He's either 97 or 102 years old. Never had a moment's chemotherapy, never took any drugs, nothing. Just went home. To a community. A real community. Not one of these McMansion gated affairs, but a little town where everybody kind of knows everybody's business. They show up for their religious festivals. Everybody chips in for the feast. It runs basically on a model that goes back to the most ancient of Greek cultures. You know, wealth was manifested in ancient Athens, not by ostentation, you know, not by building a car elevator, or in that case perhaps a chicken elevator, I don't know, but by the degree to which you could make the local annual or semi-annual or whatever festivals even awesomer. And that's how they do it. There are other communities, Costa Rica's Nicoya Peninsula. The article notes the longest lived women in the world are found on the Isle of Okinawa. There's a group of long lived Seventh-day Adventists in Loma Linda, California. Some communities have been kind of debunked over the years. But these are very real. And the research on the island of Ikaria has shown that it's a totality. It's not that they eat greens. It's not that they drink wine. It's not that they take naps. You know, the local physician on the island doesn't open before 10 o'clock in the morning because he says nobody will be there. And there are really profound questions to be answered out of all of this. Is this an indictment of modern life ever since the advent of what? Mechanization? It would certainly seem to be an indictment of mechanized food production, an indictment of chemistry over cooking. Perhaps an indictment of technology, because in reading this entire article, I never saw a blessed word about anybody sitting down to the interweb tubes, and that's kind of tough in light of the fact that, well, you know, this is an internet radio show. Marty noting, sounds like a place the Christians forgot to go and convert. Wait a bit, the Reaper will be there following the Christians. No, the Christians are already there. But it's some of the oldest Christianity in the world to the extent that it's Greek Orthodox. Remember, Saul of Tarsus, who changed his name once he was on the run. Saul of Tarsus? Never heard of him. Me? Oh, my name's Paul. Nah, different guy. But the Greek communities of Asia Minor and the Peloponnese and Attica and the Greek islands were among the first to be evangelized by Saul of Tarsus and the religion he had invented. And the church serves as a community hub. And that's okay. Because I haven't seen a lot of stories about Greek Orthodox churches from the islands of the Aegean meddling in American politics. Know what I mean? One thing that stuck out, however, was that Ikaria apparently was the place that a lot of Greek communists were sent when the communists were being ostracized. The very word itself comes from ancient Greek culture. A little tiny hunk of broken pottery is an ostracon. And once a year, the Athenian democracy would get together and decide who they wanted to throw out for the year. And it was usually the previous year's ruler. And so everybody wrote whosever name they hated on the little piece of pottery and put it in a hat. And they did not look in the hat and translate golden tablets. Instead, they counted the names in the hat, and whoever had the most votes got chucked out. And it was called being ostracized. Or that's what we call it. Based on the name of the hunk of pottery. Pottery shard. So, a bunch of Greek communists were ostracized and wound up on Ikaria. And went about the business of building community. Isn't that fascinating? The science, I get the sense, is being done for science's sake, to figure out what it is that that's going on that causes folks to live a long time. But in a world that is driven by commerce and avarice, it's hard not to realize in the passage in the story that talks about how wine is not as popular among the young people of the island anymore, or the local herbal teas. But now the stores down by the harbor sell potato chips and soda pop. And so I suppose you could say that the serpent is into the garden. You know, so seldom does it prove that ruin comes in the form of a chatty copperhead or a gossipy water moccasin. Comes instead in the form of profit. Oh, but you can have a lot of money doing this. Really? Going to live to be 102? No, probably 57. Then why don't you take your potato chips and stick them up your ass? Communist? Well, so even though this knowledge is being pursued for the sake of science, you know that how long? Before, if you happen to tune across the dial to some right-wing radio show on the terrestrial airwaves, that you hear, just like the Greek islanders who lived to, you can be like the Greek islanders who lived to be 102. For only $39.95 for a month's supply, we will send you our capsule of the refined extract of the Artemisia marjoram wild mint wild fennel tea extract. Oxy, that Dayton, right, the fennel, Edna, Ron, and Lone, the operators are standing by. And to the extent that we've had a conversation of late, for instance, about the mysterious undecided voter out there somewhere licking Velcro, it's also a discussion of we, as so-called modern people's inability to parse the bad from the good, or to drive from our midst the things and processes that are wholly bad for us. I mean, I'm a meat eater. It grosses me out. I saw a photograph the other day of pink slime. It looked like strawberry frozen custard just out of the machine. It was before it got bathed in the ammonia bath to kill all the goop in it. Wow, was it gross. I like beef. Don't like the gaminess of mutton or goat. But you know what? I bet you could get used to it. I bet you could learn to like it. I bet you if the day was coming to an end and you were gathering with a bunch of friends, like us, and you just walked up to the hilltop to watch the sun set over the Aegean to the west, and you were maybe drinking a cup of that herbal tea or a glass of that wine, maybe had a whole bottle of it sitting there waiting. Somebody with a fiddle or a guitar. All right, a bouzouki, if we must. I'll bet you could think that life was pretty good. Agreed? Do we have, in the Western world, is there an undiagnosed mass illness that has something to do with the constant need for stimulation because we are otherwise damn near numb? If you had that little slice of paradise and you saw the avaricious monsters trying to sneak in the form of soda pop and potato chips, wouldn't you be tempted to go down there and throw a lot of it out in the harbor? Maybe you could call your movement poisoned enough already and be the pea party. And I offer up on this Thorn in the Side Thursday, I offer up this little interlude, not as some sort of sermonette, but as a means of trying to sort of do a reset. Because we are in the middle of some nasty, nasty business. Hateful business. It's hard to get from day A to day B when you are assaulted on all sides by liars, monsters, sociopaths, you know, Republicans. And you really begin to yearn for that hilltop overlooking what Homer called the wine-dark sea and a blazing sun settling into it. You yearn for that. You're reminded, or at least I was, of the words, and I've quoted them here before, and I love how things kind of wrap around based upon the way this is written, the words of William Wordsworth from 1806. The industrial age was just dawning. And a few people had the vision to see what it was going to wreak on the pastoral life of, in this case, England. Watching an England that was already racked with the toils and torments of commerce gone wild. Wordsworth said, "The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We've given our hearts away, a sordid boon. The sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers, for this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn." We've been bellyaching about the world forced upon us for over 200 years. For over 2,000. For those who read the Bible, it really has been going on for a long time. Take, for instance, the fourth chapter of Genesis. The first two verses tell us of the birth of Cain and Abel, and we understand, since we're intelligent enough to recognize myths when we see them, that Cain and Abel were not really two people. Neither were Adam and Eve. But that this is instead a cautionary tale told by an ancient people to itself to keep itself in line. And in process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering. But unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect, and Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, "Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou dost well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou dost not well, sin lieth at the door, and unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him." And Cain talked with Abel, his brother. It probably went something like, "Abel, you got any idea what that old coot in the sky was talking about?" And Abel said, "No, I was over here taking care of the sheep. I didn't catch it. What did he say?" And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him. And what we have there is a description of Abel, the hunter-gatherer. And Cain, the proto-farmer. It's not just the fact that God doesn't like vegetables. Come on, really? Really, Cain, you're putting onions and garlic on the altar when you know I like the smell of burning blood? Nothing pleaseth me more than the smell of a living thing that has been murdered on a rock in my name. Take your rutabagas and go. No, it's about a people's misgivings about settling down to the agrarian lifestyle instead of the more free-form existence of the hunter-gatherer. And now we find ourselves having another crisis a couple of thousand years on. And it's a crisis born of the fact that we are driven like Abel's sheep to the slaughter. Every day, relentlessly, buy this, buy that. The Stones sang about it a little more than 150 years after Wordsworth wrote about it. The Stones sang about it in I Can't Get No Satisfaction. He can't be a man 'cause he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me. So I simply offer up this little interlude, and we can go back into the swamp anytime that you want. Phone lines will be open in a moment. And by the way, you'll have to use the direct dial number 304-658-3333. Because we have not paid the hostage vig as yet. Don't have the grand they want. It's not because we didn't pay bills. It's because this is one we refuse to pay. It's one thing to pay for things that have been delivered. It's another to be extorted. But anyway, the lines will be open, and we can talk about all manner of things political. Oh, Lord, yes, we can. But I don't know about you. I get a little bit hungry to get away. Maybe hungry's not the right word. But I get an urge to let our minds think about other things. Things that aren't so poisonous. Things that aren't so toxic. Things that contribute to the idea of community. And that's the next question, I suppose. Is it the magic of Ikaria? Or is it the magic of humans doing what humans do best and building real community? One of the things that the article brings up is that you will not be allowed to not be a member of the community. You will be cajoled out of your little hermit hole to come and participate in the singing, in the dancing, in drinking the wine, in the potlucks and the green and the gathering of the greens, in the slaughter of the goat. I think the etymology of the word tragedy has something to do with the sound a goat makes before it knows it's going to the slaughter. Because they know. especially when it's a little goat. The PETA people are weeping in the aisles right now. Would it be possible, in the midst of the consumerist, capitalized, free market madness that is this country, to have that community? And the Loma Linda Seventh-day Adventist culture suggests yes. Second question, can you do this without an imaginary friend? I'll bet you the answer to that is yes, too. Dr. John writes in, he says, eat like a forager, live longer. It's simply true, Bob. The San foragers of the Kalahari, the Maasai pastoralists of East Africa, are among the healthiest populations on Earth. That's the case with basically anyone who doesn't eat a Western diet. Lots of processed foods, lots of sugars and carbs. The Maasai eat mostly products from their cows, milk and yogurt and blood. Yet they have lower incidence of heart disease, high cholesterol, and cancer than Americans do. Among the San, broad-ranging foragers whose diet is almost entirely raw, cavities and diabetes are unknown. If you live past infancy, a somewhat riskier proposition, but not horrifyingly so, you're as likely in a small-scale foraging or pastoral culture to live into your 70s as we are, and more likely to reach your 80s and 90s. We started to die earlier and spend our final years in decline once we started intensive farming. That's also, incidentally, when we started to own things, and we developed priests and kings and cops to keep everyone quiet about this great invention, hierarchy, that had sprung up. Hell of a trade, isn't it? Why don't you be my serf? And I'll make your life miserable for about 50 years, and then you, okay, 40, and then you get to die. Sound good? Good, let's settle down and build a castle. And a cathedral. I think it was established quite some time back, John can correct me if I'm wrong, that based upon the evidence we have, hunter-gatherers actually had more leisure time than you or I in this, the greatest country in the world. That's why I get kind of misty-eyed when I think about the cultures that white folks overran when they came to this continent. I saw a brilliant cartoon by the artist Boers on my Facebook page today. Boers has apparently got a Kickstarter campaign going to try to fund the self-publishing of a book of his cartoons. And I've seen his stuff in the past. He's brilliant. I'm sure you're familiar with him. But Michael, another Michael, posted it on my Facebook wall, the Boers cartoon compendium called Life Begins at Incorporation. Looks like it'd be worth having. And there's one cartoon that features a couple of Indians sitting out on the res, young guy, old guy, listening to the radio. Out of the radio comes the announcer voice, non-white babies now outnumber white babies in America for the first time. And the older of the two Indians says, second. Took me a minute, but it's true. Jack from Shreveport writing in about Ikaria. Maybe they live longer, at least in part, because every minute of their lives is not spent competing against each other or some other group. whereas we live in a society in which there's even competition for what pre-kindergarten program a child gets into. It's the American way. Jack also notes in regard to leisure time that even peasants in the kingdoms had more leisure time than we do. Yeah. So, like I said, just a little interlude to get us started on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. On the way, the Green News Report, Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, and then your calls, 304-658-3333. If you've got that, we had great audio from Jan in the UK last night, and Skype is up and running. No, it's not. It will be in a minute. If you want to join in that way, just search for Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, and we'll get you on the air that way. It's all very doable. And every last bit of it is an exercise in this now 8-year-long attempt at redefining conversation in the internet age, at creating some manifestation of community in a culture that despises it. So we'll be back. Light them up if you want to. The phone lines and anything else for that matter. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. It is your voice. It's conversation radio. And it is, in fact, the horn.
I'm in a hurry to get things done. Oh, I rush and rush until life's no fun. All I really gotta do is live and die, but I'm in a hurry and don't know why. Don't know why. I have to drive so fast. My car has nothing to prove. It's not you, but it'll do 0 to 60 in 5.2.
I'm in a hurry. every night, but I ain't in a hurry and don't know why.
Thursday, October 25th, 2012.
I think it's going to be a big one.
Hurricane Sandy threatens East Coast as new study shows increase in big hurricanes in the U.S. Koch brothers trying to kill wind industry. Judge rules keep the mutants out of the national forests. Plastic pollution now in the Arctic. The ozone hole shrinks. Plus,
so if nothing else changes, the outlook looks pretty bad.
Time's running out to see the Great Barrier Reef. Half of it has been lost in just 30 years.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Scientists have to stop trying to make Americans care about climate change with big words like carbon and human life.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
They have to explain that it caused a super drought which killed the corn, which was used to feed the hogs, which is causing a bacon shortage. And if you can't make Americans care about something by explaining it in terms of bacon, give up.
I give up. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, bacon shortage aside, I know you've got a lot to report about global warming with big words like carbon and hurricanes and stuff like that.
And people and things, yes. While the presidential campaign is in the final stretch, surprise, there are other things happening in the world. Some quick headlines. A federal judge has ordered the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to halt field testing of genetically modified plants on land in the nation's wildlife refuges, at least until full environmental studies can be conducted of the impact of genetically modified plants in areas that are designated to be protected for wildlife.
Why would they want to have genetically modified organisms in a national forest?
Because it's cheap to test them there.
Oh, okay. What could possibly go wrong?
The oil industry is trying to strangle the American wind industry. The U.S. wind industry has been forced to idle factories and lay off workers while waiting to see if Congress will renew the annual wind production tax credit that expires in December. But American Energy Alliance, an oil industry front group with ties to the billionaire Koch brothers, tells Politico that its primary goal in the lame duck session after the election will be to make renewal of the wind energy production tax credit, quote, so toxic that Republicans House Speaker John Boehner can't even consider it.
And that is the tax credit that essentially allows for new wind farms to be built across the U.S.
Yeah, it is the main investment vehicle that has helped explode the wind industry.
Thanks, Koch brothers. You rock.
A Frankenstorm for Halloween?
We are talking about a confluence of events here. We saw kind of a similar thing with the perfect storm in 1991. We could see something similar with this.
As of airtime, it's too early to know if Hurricane Sandy, after pummeling the Caribbean, will hit the East Coast around Halloween, just 1 week before the presidential election, or whether it will veer out to sea. The National Hurricane Center is warning the Northeast to prepare. But the appearance of Hurricane Sandy neatly coincides with a new study recently published showing that extreme hurricanes are hitting the U.S. more frequently now than in the past. An analysis of nearly 100 years of storm surge and tide records show that large Katrina-sized hurricanes are now twice as likely to form off the southeast coast of the United States in warm years rather than in colder years. That's a trend they predict will increase in the future as global warming increases.
And the storm we're talking about here could be potentially a superstorm. This isn't just a regular hurricane. This is a hurricane plus.
Yeah, it could be a real biggie. The warming of the world's oceans is also stressing the world's coral reefs.
There's no exaggeration. This is absolutely unassailable data.
A recent survey of the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia shows that half of the reef has disappeared in just the last 30 years, and the outlook is grim, says John Gunn of the Australian Institute for Marine Science here in an interview with the BBC.
So if nothing else changes, the outlook looks pretty bad. And remember, these changes are happening before the major impacts of climate change have kicked in.
The researchers say the destruction is due to stronger cyclones and warming oceans, but also a voracious starfish that eats coral. It's exploded in population in just a few years due to chemical fertilizer runoff from farms. On the other side of the world, plastic pollution is now at the North Pole. Arctic Ocean biologists in a new survey say photographic evidence shows plastic litter on the seafloor of the Arctic is rapidly increasing and becoming entangled in marine life as shipping traffic increases due to the loss of Arctic sea ice. Finally, some good news.
Finally.
The ozone hole over the South Pole is the second smallest it's been in 20 years, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The ozone layer protects all life on Earth from the sun's deadly ultraviolet rays. The slow recovery of the ozone layer shows that the world's first international climate treaty to phase out ozone-killing chemicals is actually succeeding. It proves that it can be done.
That was a cap-and-trade treaty from George Bush Sr., as I recall.
Yep, it shows Republicans used to care about such things.
Those were the days. For more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves until the Koch brothers decide to strangle us. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes past the second hour of the program. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com. Remember, if you missed out at the beginning of the program, you can, at least until the podcasts are back up to normal speed again, you can set a recorder at dar.fm and simply record the program and listen to it later. During the break, I had an email come in from Jay. Subject line, simply live. That comes, of course, from the old saying, live simply so that others might simply live. Jay says, Bob, your discussion of simpler lifestyles tonight fits right in with my thinking of late. I spent the winter of 1999-2000 in Nicaragua working with an organization named El Porvenir out of Boulder, Colorado. They're at El Porvenir, ELPORVENIR.org. These Nicaraguan mountain villages are subsistence farmers. They have almost no money. They meet their needs by hard work and cooperation. One thing I took away from my visit to these people was this. While there, I never heard a baby cry. This was because young children are so well taken care of that they have no reason to cry. These are the wonderful people I am considering joining, or at least emulating. And I don't think anyone would dare suggest, Jay, that that's a bad idea. I dare suggest that, in fact, there's a lot of folks who would like to go with you. But that in itself is a problem, isn't it? To one degree or another, the world's great religions teach that envy is some sort of violation of the universal code. Their word for it is sin. And I'm not talking about Jay going down. I'm talking about this idea that that somehow we must. Oh, how can I put it? Look, we got to reinvent it for ourselves. Sometimes reinventing the wheel is what you have to do. You know, that's an old cliche. Well, you know, you don't want to reinvent the wheel. Maybe sometimes you do. Maybe sometimes the wheel that works on one path will not work on another, and it has to be rediscovered. So maybe that's the question. And I say this understanding that other commune/utopian movements have gone across this country from time to time. Among other things, they sprang up like mushrooms after a spring rain in the era that was populated by the thoughts of folks like Emerson and Thoreau. And most of them devolve into heartbreak and failure because they lack the organic, and I don't mean grown without fertile, they lack the organic necessities to make it work. One individual, like the fellow who left America and went back to his home in Icaria, can be absorbed into a community. It is an open question, however, whether a community can spontaneously form. And that's an important inquiry. Because when one has been subjected to a particular lifestyle or life way long enough, the habits are awfully hard to break. That Alabama song I played about I'm in a hurry to get things done, kind of the opposite side of that coin is a Grateful Dead tune I've played from, not Grateful Dead, Talking Heads tune I've played from time to time, called Nothing But Flowers. That was a parking lot. Now it's a peaceful oasis. You got it. You got it. We've caught a rattlesnake. Now we've got something for dinner. You got it. You've got it. It's an open question how long any of us could watch that beautiful sun sink into the wine-dark Aegean before we said, "Please, can I have my internet back?" I don't know what the answers are to the questions for the television generation. Interestingly, these centenarians that are being written about in the article I cited, they're all people who were probably 50 years old before they ever saw a television. How many in our culture would be able to live the day in and day out of that hard work that Jay is talking about that takes place in Central America? Because before you earn your leisure time, you work your ass off. Most all of us have ancestors who did that. I'm within a couple of miles of cemeteries that are chock full of my forebears who lived into their 90s, ate, and passed their genetic material to me, and ate pig fat day in and day out. Their biscuits were made with lard. And they ate probably more pork than anything else. They ate eggs until they did. Right? But what did they do different? They worked their asses off. They rose with the sun and went to bed with it too. Old Ozias Goad, coming in at the end of the day with his three apples from his trees, sitting on a shelf that hung by his rocking chair, his hard-backed wooden rocking chair that was his sitting place of an evening. We still have the cut glass goblet in which my great-grandmother would bring him one glass of warm sugar water that he would sip at as he peeled his apple and shared it out with the children before he read them the Bible and then capped it all off by playing his banjo for them. And in the warm months of summer, the sun might not even have set before everyone was in bed. And in the cold months of winter, well, the sun would have been long gone, and precious oil being burned in a lamp by which to read the Word of God, and then play the music of the soul. Just a little food for thought. I'm so sick of rape as a gift from God. Sick to death of it. Yeah, you can't discount that, Marty. One, they did work their butts off. Two, their food, I'll dare say, was grown locally in earth that was untainted. No agribusiness. Yeah. It's what Dr. John said about surviving past infancy. That really was the hurdle. What, in Elizabethan England, children might be baptized with a name that they were really sort of taken care enough, well enough of to survive, but you didn't get attached to them until they were 7 years old. Because you really didn't have a sense that they would live. And these horses' rear ends from the right wing would dare to tell us that life begins at conception. Why not life begins at implantation of the zygote in the uterine wall? Well, that's because then you'd have to have somebody, you know, to actually monitor when that happens. Well, that's okay. The right wing would be more than happy to provide some womb police, as long as, you know, it was done for profit. No, I'm not having a meltdown or anything. But it's getting pretty thick. On a more personal note, and this is just to keep you abreast of my ongoing medical adventures, I'm sickly. No, I got a rotten gallbladder, and the surgeon, before he goes any further with my gallbladder, wanted me to see a cardiologist. Because, you know, I'm nearly 50, and I come from a family of men who die of heart disease. It's one of those things you start dealing with at 50. So I called the, I got a hold of the cardiologist today. They said, well, we need to run an echocardiogram, and we want to do a stress test on you. I've had those in the past. It's no big deal. And I said, well, great. And they said, well, you know, we need you to pay for it up front. I said, can't make payments? Oh, no. How much is it? $1,500 cash on the barrel head. We take MasterCard and Visa. I said, you know anybody that's got one of those I can use? Well, you call the doctor back and say that you refused the appointment. I said, no, ma'am, I'm going to call the doctor back and tell him that you would not schedule one without me bringing you $1,500 cash on the barrel head. Good day. That's my world. And the world of millions of other Americans. This is the kind of thing that we mean when we say that 45,000 Americans die every year, not from untreatable illness, but from lack of access to health care insurance. Welcome to America. So I'm going to do what I can. I got some. I've had some really nice things written to me over the last couple of weeks. Things that one of the big things seems to be Bob consume vinegar. Put a tablespoon of nice organic unfiltered vinegar in a glass of apple juice and chug it once a day. I can do that. I'm gonna. Bob, eat lots of raw garlic. Do that too. But even if I do it, it doesn't change what's being done to the millions of others. Because there are problems far greater than any that I face. And yeah, that's part and parcel of why when I go to the polls, even though it won't mean much here in West Virginia, because they'll probably get beaten 60-40 at least, if not 80-20, because of the war on coal. That's why I will be making my way to the polls, and I will, in fact, be voting for Barack Obama for President of the United States. Because somebody out there is depending on me, too. Millions of somebodies are out there depending on me to do that. The working couple who are too wealthy for Medicaid and can't, and yet can't afford, say, Walmart's employer health plan, but could, on January the 1st, 2014, be covered under Medicare under the expanded poverty guidelines. They're depending on me to go and vote for Barack Obama. Yeah, I like Jill Stein's positions a hell of a lot more. But there is not even a 1 in 10 trillion chance of Jill Stein becoming President of the United States. I saw a picture of Pakistani children on Facebook earlier today. And it said, just hope Barack Obama doesn't put them on his kill list. And I was a little bit taken aback. I find the drone strikes to be disgusting. By the same token, I find carpet bombings by B-52s to be equally or more so. But I think what I found most disgusting was this notion that somebody out there, arguably on our side of the fence, thinks that Barack Obama sits around... Could you bring me some photographs of Pakistani children for my kill list? We wiped out a few dozen, and I've got to catch up. That's odious, too. The murdering is done, and it is murder. Cold-blooded murder. The murdering's done by the CIA like the murdering has always been done by the CIA. Some pimply-faced little kid with a goddamn joystick flying a drone around blasting the bejesus out of weddings, Muslim weddings. Barack Obama's kill list, please. You want to see a kill list? Wait till you see Willard Romney's. Man, you haven't even begun to think about a kill list till you see what happens when a Mormon bishop gets a hard-on for murder. Mountain Meadows, anyone? It's getting a little thick. I admit it. And it's taking a toll on all of us. Sorry if I'm not a hell of a lot of fun. I was actually trying to get away from the swamp, and it seems the swamp we have always with us. Oh, by the way, I mentioned the war on coal. And how Obama gone to war with the coal industry, putting hard working men and women out on the streets with his war on coal and the Kenyan EPA, right? I don't want to break any hearts or anything, but it's a lie. You know that. What's funny, though, is that even the coal companies know that. One coal company in particular. Consol Energy, they're the coal company that blew up the mountain about 2 miles from where I live. They've got a great big old mine over in Virginia. The Buchanan Mine. And they laid off 620 workers not too long back. And a representative from Virginia named Morgan Griffith said, it's because of the administration's ongoing war on coal. The Republicans naturally echoed that. GOP in Virginia saying, the Environmental Protection Agency has followed through with regulations shut down the mine. Because there's a war on coal. There's only one problem. There isn't a war on coal. And guess what? As of a press release last week, Consol Energy expects to produce 13.4 to 13.8 million tons during the quarter, including 0.6 million tons at the Buchanan mine, which is expected to restart on the week of November 5th. But they're not retracting their war on coal bullshit. Because they lie. And lying is what liars do best. War on coal. Fascinating story out of the Washington Post. About the war on coal. There's no war on coal, but there damn sure is a war on people. It turns out that, according to the Washington Post, which cites real, you know, thinking kind of egg-headed, pointy-headed economist types. Well, Tom Tenzillo, or Tenzillo, is a former senior official in the New York State Comptroller's Office, and he's a financial consultant now. And he says in this Washington Post article, the issues aren't mine inspectors and environmentalists. It's a geological fact of life in central Appalachia. You mine for 100 years and you take a lot of coal. It's the cost of production. That's the reality of it. It's getting too expensive to mine here. Imagine how expensive it must be when they're not using, they're barely using a tenth of the labor force that they used in 1980. They're using mechanized methods of acquisition, like mountaintop removal. And it's still expensive. Then there's Marie Shamarik, a director at Standard & Poor's. She follows the mining industry. She says, we've been relatively negative on Central Appalachia for quite some time because it's an expensive area to mine. It's been mined out and has thinning coal seams. Well, then it's not like they're getting any thinner. It's just they've gotten all the thick stuff. And so when they blow up enough mountains to constitute the entire area of the state of Delaware, it's because they're trying to get at seams of coal that are sometimes 6 inches thick. It's been mined out and it has thinning coal seams. We've been mining there forever. She continued, Central Appalachia is being squeezed the most. At natural gas prices today, the coal in a lot of those mines is not really competitive. And you're seeing a lot of the utilities in that area have moved to natural gas. But then, even where the coal is fairly easy to get at, she dropped a bit of a, I hate to say it, but a bombshell. Is there 200 years' supply of coal at today's prices? Probably not. But there is a lot. That whole a lot part is a relative phrase. There's not a lot. There's enough. There is enough coal in the ground in central Appalachia, in the Illinois Basin, in the Powder River Basin, to make sure that we render this planet inhospitable, intolerant to human life. Which I guess is the other side of the coin. Let's say you're able to build that community that eats a lot of antioxidant-bearing greens, and you drink tea of an evening sweetened with honey from your local bees, the ones that survive. And that provides a boatload of cancer-preventing agents. And you dance like something out of Zorba the Greek. And you laugh into your 90s. Well, what if the planet itself becomes no longer willing or able to tolerate you in your 90s? Because that's where we're headed. Giant storms. You heard the Green News report. Good God. And by the way, did you notice that this storm is named Sandy? T-U-V-W-X-Y. We're seven letters of the alphabet away from having to restart at A. Do we always get to S? Sandy. Sandy! Ferg does that real well, you know, from Greece. I was really trying to get away from some of the negativity, and I've wandered back into it. I'm so sorry. Should I just play music? Fresh out of Bazooki music, I'm afraid. News Ninja Gene has a question. Bob, do you think your vote would be more likely to count if you voted early? No. I had to do that at one point, maybe this year or last. I went in there and they had one of those optical scan machines. That's my choice, optical scan or video game. And the lady at the table said, would you like to try our new electronic voting machine? And I said, good God, no. I'd like for my vote to count. And it's bad enough with the optical scan. The chances of my vote being counted that way are slim enough. I don't want to move down to zero. You know, and she said, you know, I don't understand why. Everybody hates those machines. I don't understand. I said, well, honey, do the homework. There's no way to verify the intent of the voter on that. There's no receipt. There's no ballot. And it could be hacked in a heartbeat. So, no, there's no likelihood that if I voted or... No, absolutely not. And when I go down to vote in my local precinct, I'll have the same choice. The one choice I do not have is, please, may I have a ballot that I can mark an X on and have somebody count it by hand? Oh, no. So, no. Well, I think at least Kate knows where I'm coming from. She says, choking on rotten political garbage. Kate says, let's talk about surviving the fascism and not dwell on what's coming. We all know what's coming. In my mind, it's already here. The ideas about how to work around the lack of too expensive medical attention need to be discussed at length from here on. Starting with exercise, no high fructose stuff, no white flour, reduced sugar intake, less time in front of the TVs and computers. Just a walk to the end of the block once a day does wonders. Sorry, Kate, we don't have blocks around here. We damn sure don't have sidewalks. Although I can go out on US 60 and duke it out with the 70-mile-an-hour coal trucks. Kate says, oh, by the way, the phone lights that aren't lit up. I suggest that the wonderful item you shared about longevity has folks reflecting, pondering, and wondering what in the world they would have to contribute. Sure did it to me. I've been pondering these ideas for weeks. These days I have no inclination to live till my 90s. Oh, goddess, deliver me, Kate says. The planet is toast, our center isn't going to hold, and I am so glad I am old. And yet there are those of us who would like to be around, I guess, for what the fireworks professionals, you know, the guys who set off, you know, like the Grouchies, Is that their name, the Grouchies? The really big ones, like over in New York Harbor. That last one where everything goes up. Boom, 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 boom. It's called the finale rack. And even though it may be either sadistic or masochistic, there are some of us who would like to be around when the finale rack goes up. But Kate does ask real and vital questions. What does it look like? What does it mean to survive in full-blown fascism? What does it mean to build, and I don't mean by radio network, what does it mean to build a network of people that you know you can trust? Where you can share technologies and techniques. Now, I'm not trying to be genderist in this, but I'll go say, you know, there are probably some women within the reach of my voice right now who really could sit down and teach a 10-year-old girl or boy how to make a quilt that would help them survive a cold and brutal winter. There are some men out there within the sound of my voice who could probably teach a little boy or a little girl how to go hunt food in the forest. But we don't have enough forest or enough animals in it to feed us all. There are people of either gender who could say, you can eat this, don't eat that. And stay away from the mushrooms until you're damn sure you're an expert. What does that look like? What does that feel like? What are the things that, what are the elements of a community that you would want to have? And what would you get rid of? I'm spoiled. I still want the internet. I don't want it because, you know, I need to go and feed my angry birds or anything. I'm an information freak. I like to know what's going on. But one of the things that article pointed out, at least to me, was that the community on that island finds enough to concern itself with in the doings of its own neighbors. Ninety-nine square miles, 10,000 people, 30 miles off the western coast of Turkey. And they talk about the fact that people don't misbehave, not because they have some god-awful prison sentence hanging over their heads, but because they don't want to shame their community. And because everybody knows everybody else's business. And anytime you've ever been to a little community festival, you know, we do one of those, you know, once a year, like Bridge Day last week. 100,000 of your closest neighbors, right? You can get a little tiny sense of it. I sensed it in Germany at that Pentecost festival with the bad 90s disco thumping into the night. On the island, the article notes, although unemployment is high, perhaps as high as 40%, most everyone has access to a family garden and livestock. People who work might have several jobs. Someone involved in tourism, for example, might also be a painter or an electrician or have a store. People are fine here because we are very self-sufficient. One individual said, we may not have money for luxuries, but we will have food on the table and still have fun with family and friends. We may not be in a hurry to get work done during the day, so we work into the night. At the end of the day, we don't go home to sit on the couch. Well, by God, you know, that's intolerable. They've got to be up at 6, out the door at 7, on the road until 8, walking into the office at 8:15. And they got to work there, by God, straight through till 5 o'clock and get home at 7 exhausted and wonder why they don't just go ahead and end it all. Right? One woman said, do you know there's no word in Greek for privacy? When everyone knows everyone else's business, you get a feeling of connection and security. The lack of privacy is actually good because it puts a check on people who don't want to be caught or who do something to embarrass their family. If your kids misbehave, your neighbor has no problem disciplining them. There's less crime, not because of good policing, but because of the risk of shaming the family. You asked me about food, and yes, we do eat better here than in America. But it's more than about how we eat. Even if it's your lunch break from work, you relax and enjoy your meal. You enjoy the company of whoever you're with. Food here is always enjoyed in combination with conversation. Well, as long as it doesn't take more than 15 minutes and you're back at your workstation, and not a second later, there is profit to be made here, don't you know? Andy writing in says, it's an assault, an absolute assault on working people in this country. The plutocrats are snuffing us out. Our food, water, politics, air, and our society are killing us. A wonderful feudal world in the USA. Just a thought, says Andy. Oh, I think it's more than a thought, Andy. I think it's a reality. Feudalism is not necessarily defined by mud and badly woven textiles.
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here.
It is defined by the way that human beings are treated by other human beings. Jack in Shreveport said, you know, that's why those CEO bastards always live in some other town. Yeah, they have community. The 1%, by God, do have community. They have bridge clubs and soirees down at the yacht basin. And they have two-hour lunches. And they enjoy the conversation of whomever they're with. But that is something to which we proles are damned well not entitled. News Ninja Gene, on the subject of food, says, actually, given my disability, I'm seriously thinking about bugs. Hopefully slow ones. That is, I think, to say the least, News Ninja Gene's wry sense of humor. Slow bugs.
Soylent Green Gene.
Don't say Green Gene. Soylent Green is people.
I love you all.
That's Agnes, and she does.
Yes, and we enjoy conversation. You don't have to be 1% to enjoy conversation.
No, that's not what I was saying, dear.
I know, but I just came back to poke you a little
They
bit.
Have their conversations. They have their leisure lifestyle. Leisure is too good for us. We are made to eat and excrete and die.
So But we don't have.
And when you have something, when you have a paradigm expressed like Ikaria, well, make no mistake. Like I said, on the one hand, you'll have somebody out there hustling. Call 800 Ikaria now, or a tourism industry will spring up, and then everybody on the island will be 100 years old. That's what happened in Georgia. They thought that they had identified a culture of centenarians. And then it turned out, no, not so much. Because suddenly money was coming into the community based on people. Hey, Eunice, let's go have some old people tourism and go look at the 100-year-olds in Georgia. So naturally, everybody who had a couple of wrinkles on their face became 100 years old. See how it works? I read this article, and I almost grieved for that island. Because the article's in the New York Times, which means the 21st century equivalent of the serpent in the garden will soon be there. And it won't be working stiff proles like us. It'll be the 1%. Oh, Muffy, let's take a plane over to Athens and then perhaps the ferry across to Ikaria. And we can live for a week like those wretched people do, and maybe it'll keep us from getting colon rectal cancer. See how it works? Yeah, I figured. Jesus, a two-hour filibobster. This is unusual. Well, it can be a three-hour filibobster, too. So we'll take a little break and come back. By the way, and I don't know to what extent the absence of the toll-free number is keeping the lights from lighting up. Didn't seem to be a problem last night. But if you want to get in on the conversation, you now have an hour in which to do it. I hate it when I sit here and say, oh, this is conversation radio, and then I filibobster for 3 hours. No, I got enough material in front of me to do five. But like I said, I admit, I'm sick of it. At least for tonight, I'm sick of it. I'm sick of the comments about what rape is and isn't, when the only people who need to be talking about what rape is and isn't are people who have experienced rape. I got one here that arrived too late for prayer meeting Wednesday. The story of Father Rolando Garcia. He's been placed on leave. That's what Holy Mother Church does when you actually ought to be indicted. Because the Archdiocese of Miami just learned today that Father Rolando Garcia, who intercedes with God Almighty and makes the miracle of the Mass happen, Father Rolando Garcia apparently, allegedly, engaged in oral sex and what is referred to as sodomy with a runaway boy Jesus. At a press conference this past Tuesday, Tony Simmons recalled that Garcia, Father Garcia, began abusing him in 1994 at the Church of the Little Flower in Hollywood, Florida. Simmons said the Catholic priest first offered him food and counseling, you know, because he was a runaway. Over time, then, Father Garcia, man of God, plied him with movies, concerts, booze, and porn. And eventually, it led to what is referred to as oral sex and sodomy. He couldn't speak up because he lived and worked as a painter at the church, which is the perfect situation in which the rape victim remains economically dependent upon the rapist. Mr. Simmons joined the military in 2003, and even then Father Garcia stayed in touch with him. Simmons said he changed his mind about coming forward when Garcia, Father Garcia, laughed while telling him that others had also accused him of pedophilia. The lawyer who represents Mr. Simmons has sued Garcia three times in the past 7 years. Two of them were settled out of court. And yet he returned to the pulpit to say magic words over a glass of over a cup of bad wine, and for all we know continue to prey upon little boys. Garcia was presently at St. Agatha Catholic Church. The Communications Office of the Archdiocese said, "The Archdiocese will offer counseling to the alleged victim and conduct an investigation following procedures outlined in Protecting God's Children." I didn't know there was a part of the Florida Code called Protecting God's Children. Well, that's mainly because there isn't. F the law, we're the church. We sell tickets out of hell and into heaven. Jesus Christ. So, yeah, little break's in order. We'll take it. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. 304-658-3333 is the number. Jump in if you want.
Give to me my time and money. Give to me my milk and honey. Give to me my self-respect. Golden chains around my neck. Give to me my supermodel. Corporate jet and champagne bottle. Get me out there on the town. Let me spread my wealth around. I could learn to love this life I lead. Just don't take away the things I need. I feel rosy in a pink. So just don't make me stop and think. Young and fit. Give to me my haute couture. Give the world a cancer cure. Serve my breakfast al fresco. Let the wine and liquor flow. I can search for truth some other time. But right now I just wanna get what's mine. Let the gangsters rule the streets while teachers try to make ends meet. I despise all bleeding. I don't fit the nice yard. Give it to me.
show some compassion. Man, that's so out of fashion.
Give to me my Aspen winner. Sorry about the World Trade Center. I can't help the ones in need. I got my own mouth to feed. Give to me my Playboy channel. Some killer weed and sheets of flannel. Lay me down upon my bed with pleasant dreams to fill my head. Just look at what this world is coming to. And there ain't one damn thing that I can do. I don't have a leg to stand on. I don't have a net to land on. I don't have the space or power. I don't have the extra hour. Give it to me. Give it to me. Tax cut outsource. Build me my own private golf course. The Dixie chicks can kiss my ass. But I still need that backstage pass. Give to me my NASDAQ numbers. Intel shells and E-Trade blunders. Soldiers to defend my freedom. And I strip on dying if I need them. And give it to me. Give it to me. Give it to me.
Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
8 minutes past the hour. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Thorn in the Side Thursday. And let us go straightway to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm well.
Well, you know, nobody's been calling in, so I thought I'd give a call. You know, it's, you know, I guess we're getting down to, what, pretty close to the election. But forget the election, the Murdoch thing and all that, Murdoch or whatever you call his name. But, you know, it's good to see you get through its 7th birthday. I was happy to see that.
Thank you very kindly. I'm sorry, I'm struggling. Give me a name, please.
Thomas.
Oh, Thomas. I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you.
Well, that's okay. I haven't called.
You don't call very often, so I don't have you imprinted yet.
No. Well, that's good. Yeah. That's
my apologies, though. Well, thanks. We're now working on year 8, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I was glad about the little report you gave on the guy from Greek islands or something like that.
Yeah. It's a Greek island, Ikaria.
Yeah, I saw your tweet, and every once in a while, I just have it logged in my mind, www.twitter.com, Bob Kincaid, and I'll pull it up there once in a while. I saw that today, and I went and read it. It's a touching story.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and especially when he talked at the very end when it says he went back to ask the doctors why he survived, but he couldn't ask them because they were all dead.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of apropos because today I got my little health plan for next year from the company. I got to look through that this weekend sometime. I think I'm going to be out a couple $100 a month come next year, but, you know, I'll deal with it. At least I have a job where, you know, I have some income to take care of it. And, you know, it's more than you can say, which is
Well, yeah, I hope Thomas that people understand. I'm not belly aching. I am trying desperately to give voice via my own story to what are the horror stories of manifestly worse situations for millions of Americans.
You know, I have a daughter-in-law that works, you know, basically she has two jobs, you know, uniquely American, but neither of them is full-time. One has health insurance for her, and she got her plan, and she's already calculated after paying for her health insurance come next year, she's going to net out of her paycheck $75. Now, I don't know what the pay cycle she has, but $75.
Well, and I don't want to be a smartass and say something like, you know, don't spend it all in one place. But Thomas, when you look at something like that in the light of, say, that story we had out of Pennsylvania that John Fox sent me last night, that shows that literally workers' own state tax withholdings could be paid to their employers.
Yeah, you know, Rick's been on that big time forever.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing this little scheme, but what they're doing is they're taking the payroll and unemployment and all that and go, hey, employer, just keep the money. Don't send it to us.
Yeah.
And then they tell everybody, we're giving them all this money and funding. Instead of having the funds come into the state and have that budgeted out, well, now they don't. Hey, it's a free ride forever.
Great, yeah, good, and good for corporate America, I guess.
Yeah. So it's sickening, you know. I did.
What do we call a structure like that, Thomas? When the purpose of government becomes dedicated to what? To becoming a tax farmer for corporations? What, I mean, is there a name for that kind of governance? I mean, is it fascism? Is it just plutocracy? Oligarchy? I'm not asking this rhetorically. I don't know.
Yeah, it's Russia in the 1990s that Haiti even talked about. They just handed off all the assets off to their chosen few.
Where does it all wind up?
Well, it winds up on our backs. We're the ones going to be carrying the damn load. I don't see anybody else going to be picking up the load, but we're going to be Serbs, and they'll be happy that we're Serbs.
And we should be happy we're Serbs, right?
Well, you know, the beating, morale improved after.
Yeah, right. The beatings will continue until morale improves, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, I keep my mouth shut at work because, you know, I know, they have me employed and that. It's just a matter of time before I have some boss comes telling me how to vote, because I see that's going on throughout these different organizations. Going to tell their workers, you ain't going to have a job if you don't vote way we want you to, and somehow I think they're going to institute some system where, and I even read something earlier this year, where, you know, in a democracy, we need to know how everybody votes. Well, we know what that's about. Know who to punish.
Right. You know, I think I may have mentioned it, Thomas, but I did something really dangerous around here. I put an Obama sign in my yard, our yard.
Yeah, and I mentioned to you an email we did a go up. Took my grandson up to the bridge today.
Yeah,
we drove up there last weekend. You got a few friends there, and Anstead has them out there too.
Yeah, that's true.
And
well, shucks, you should have sent me a note or something. I mean, it's hard to get her over. You know, meet me on the bridge doesn't exactly work on bridge day.
No. And to find somebody in that crowd, for, you know, you can forget that. But it was nice. Let's do a nice day trip. It was a beautiful.
Did you stay? Did you stay for the chili cook-off?
No.
Good for you.
We got there. I actually saw some woman with a big shirt with the four-letter word on it, and it started with the letter C, and it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I did wear my corporate jacket with all NASCAR, patches on it, so I fit in real well.
Well, if you're down this way and it's not something as zany as Bridge Day, you know, shoot me a note or something. If I can get anywhere near it, you know, I'd love to get. It's always a joy every chance I get to. Every chance I get to meet another member of the extended Horn family is a joy for me.
Sure, and for us to take a day trip down there wasn't a big deal because what we did was we went up there, you know, there at Caldwell, just north of Marietta. We headed off east there, or actually we headed off on 827 or something like that, and went up to the cabin and we lit the fire and stayed the night there.
Oh, nice.
We weren't going to drive all the way back. We lit a fire, and, we had enough food with us to take care of the grandson. And all.
I hope it was really special for him most of all.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mentioned he has pretty Willie, and, he will not walk that far. He can do a sit-down. You're not going to get him up. So we took a wheelchair with us, and we wheeled him all the way down to the bridge, up the hill, down the hill, to the bridge. And it was great. And, we had back down, what is that, Route 60? Back into Charleston. It was about the only way for us, it's the most practical way to get in there. But your mountains are beautiful, I got to say that.
Well, what's left of them.
Yeah, well, I think,
See, if you got out to the middle of the bridge and you looked downriver, you can see sort of a scrubby-looking line. Well, that used to be a mountain, Thomas. That mountain is no longer there.
Yeah, well, they had us on the south side of the bridge.
Right.
So looking down there was,
Well, did you drove by that great big Walmart plaza, right, there in Fayetteville?
No. No, I came down to Anstead.
Oh, okay, so you didn't see that. Well, you at the top of the ramp, at the top where the parking lot begins at the Wally World, you can look off across the road and you can see where they're blasting the bejesus out of another set of mountains there. Those are the mountains that they're shipping to India.
Right. Now I have a place somewhere down along Route 61 there.
Yeah.
Right. So we came down 60 and. As far as every map, as far as getting down there, it said go 60. I looked at.
Right.
That's the way we went. But, and that beautiful resort down there along that river, it was just gorgeous.
Hawk's Nest? Yeah, that used to be known as Marshall's Pillars, named for Chief Justice John Marshall, who visited the area. But the oldest part of Hawk's Nest is, of course, CCC construction. You can tell from the stonework.
Well, what was good for me was going down and see just what you're trying to protect. And any foreign listener, in your shot or within driving distance can take a day trip and go just see the majesty of what you're trying to protect. I would encourage them to do that.
Well, thank you, Thomas. It is worth saving.
It is.
These communities are very old, and in some places, they've even blasted away cemeteries with War of 1812 veterans in them.
I'm gonna let you go, and hopefully more people call in. I always try to call in on your landline there because it's not gonna put a dent in my budget, I don't think. And
I appreciate it, and as soon as I can negotiate a settlement with these people, we'll get the 800 number back. But I'm not going to pay them. I'm not going to pay them for services they never rendered.
Yeah, well, it's like right now, it sounds like you're dealing with an extortion war bracket.
Well, it is, and if I could call up a lawyer buddy and say, why don't you send these guys a nasty gram? I probably would because they're in breach of their own contract.
I wish you luck for you and us because it's great to have a human conversation with people.
Well, thank you, Thomas. I appreciate it. And really, next time you get down this way, give a holler.
I will.
All right.
Good night.
Take care, Thomas. Bye now. I feel really bad I didn't recognize Thomas's voice. But that's Thomas Jug a Punch from the chat room. He He's there every month helping us keep this all lit up. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes.
Hi, this is Harry.
Hey, Harry, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm well, I think.
I was happy to let you talk for the entire 3 hours, what you were talking about tonight and last.
But I feel very embarrassed when I do that, Harry.
Well, that's actually why I called. I figured maybe I didn't know how many people were going to call.
I feel like I'm taking up somebody else's time.
Oh, no, no. Well, you're also, as you said, I agree with this, you know, you are giving voice to things that should be given voice to, and I actually decided to call in and to try to sort of add on or augment what you were been talking about, not only tonight but last night. But before I do that, I wanted to congratulate you on your anniversary the other night. You know, as you know, and some of your Horn listeners know, I'm a relatively recent convert, and but I, in the past 4 or 5 months, I guess, and I have to tell, I also tell this to all the other members of the Horn family. I've been telling people here. I live in Washington D.C. that I tell anybody who listens and my friends that. Your program is, in my opinion, you know, the most, frankly, the most profound sort of cultural, social program on any, you know, kind of radio today, whether internet or terrestrial. And I really mean that. I'm not a person who, you know, says things to...
No, I can tell when I'm being shined on, and I don't think you're doing that.
No. As I tell people, I'm one of the... least competent brown nosers in Washington D.C. where I live. I mean, among living.
Well, and that can make living in D.C. kind of hard.
Yeah, yes, it can. But I sometimes say it as when I'm trying to make sure that people understand that I'm not being hyperbolic or exaggerating or trying to charm them into anything, but that I'm being honest about my feelings and thoughts. So I'm very proud, really, even to be a novice or a new member of the Horn family, because I appreciate your program so much, and I do understand, and I know you this concerns you a little bit, but I do understand that you are, even when you're saying things and being very concerned or being very outraged, that you're really trying to give voice to other people as well, and I deeply appreciate that.
Well, I thank you. I thank you more than you can know, Harry. It's not overt, but by the same token, I don't know how to describe it. It's just that over the course of the years, this effort has become different from when it started. I mean, when we started, we had little ad breaks and everything, because we just knew we were going to go to terrestrial radio any minute.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but you know, in a sense, as you have said, you know, this is an experiment on internet radio, and you know, this indeed, I mean, you could be, and I hope you will be, and I think you already are, but I also hope you will be seen in the future as a pioneer in this kind of radio, because in fact people can talk about things and say things here that, as you have noted many times, maybe couldn't be said on on terrestrial radio, either because of FCC regulations or even just because of the nature of, you know, of broadcasting and the need for commercials, et cetera. And certainly I've listened to daytime, you know, so-called progressive hosts who are constantly, you know, cutting off their callers after 30 seconds. And I know you've said that this is the thing you did not want to do.
No.
And in fact, if anything, you wanted to lengthen your conversations and have in-depth conversations, and I think you have succeeded at that. And I'm and looking at the clock, trying not to take up too much more of your time when I say that, but I think that is, you know, what you've done, and I think you have succeeded at it admirably.
Well, I do. I appreciate it. And but none of this. If I was just sitting here 3 hours a night filibustering. While
yeah.
some people can get some enjoyment out of it, and you know, the 3 hour filibuster after I came back from Europe, I didn't mind doing because there was a lot of story to get out.
Yeah.
but just well, to, just to do it, I mean, what we're talking about here is a sincere offering, Harry, because there is no, and I'm trying not to swear, but there's no dialogue in this country. There is no community conversation.
Well, this is why, as I said, I've told everyone I know that this is, you know, your program, that I rarely miss it because it's really the most profound thing, kind of, you know, broadcasting that I have found in this country or really anywhere.
I remember the time,
myself,
but, and you never know where exactly the roots are coming from. But I remember being a little boy, and I think I've said in the past, the first time I ever heard a man screaming in anger was not my father.
Mm-hmm.
It was the man of God standing in the pulpit at the Baptist church, and he scared me to death.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember later on looking at my mother, who was incredibly devout, and saying, when people have questions, why don't they raise their hands and ask the preacher questions?
It's a profound question.
And she said, well, because that's not done.
Well, children sometimes, you know, ask the most profound things. And, you know, I mean, in a way, I grieve for that sometimes, that the curiosity of children, you know, somehow gets extinguished along the way.
Oh, and it doesn't just, and again, that's a phrase that keeps coming back into discussion more and more lately, Harry. That's by design, too.
Right. Yeah, well, actually, I would agree with that, and we could talk about that. And
I mean, if you have a chance to go over to PrismWV, PrismWV.org, and catch last Sunday's chat discussion between Professor Keith and Dr. Bill, and their discussion of Plato's analogy of the cave, and what that means in terms of how we go about the idea of the very, you know, the Platonic idea of education, if you will.
Right.
I think you'll find echoes of the same thing.
Oh, sure. And, you know, and I certainly don't want to bore the Horn family with this, but, you know, we could talk about even, you know, contemporary writers and old school of thought about these things, like the school of critical pedagogy and various people, and even people today like Henry Giroux, who is a professor at McMaster University, writes a lot of columns for Truthdig, you know, about, and even before that, I mean, back in the 50s, there was an anthropologist, very brilliant man, named Jules Henry, who wrote a lot about education and mental health in the U.S. And he used to talk about, you know, the needs of society and how, in fact, society did not want, you know, intelligent students or intelligent adults, because it would have destroyed the society. There was a need to keep people stupid in a way, he was saying, although he said it much more eloquently than I just did. But if I may, I just wanted to just briefly comment on some of the things you've been talking about the last few nights and just
sure.
Say some things that maybe I hope. I mean, I called because I thought, well, and, you know, as you know, Bob, I've discussed with you at least few times privately the fact that I have certainly enough of my own problems to worry about, but I did want to just add some personal observations, because I think the things that you've been talking about are really very serious. First of all, I read the article after your show. I read the whole article about the from the Amherst student, the woman who had been raped.
Yes.
And yes, and I, you know, of course, you were able to sort of, you wanted to, and I think did that very well, you know, hook this up with the whole dialogue of all of these right-wing politicians that don't seem to understand what rape even means, or, you know, and how it affects an individual's life, you know.
I think it extends, not to break into your idea, yeah. Harry, but I think it extends past that.
Oh yeah, sure.
I think when you get right down to it, you know, if you took a Richard Murdoch, and put him in a chair and duct taped him real good and fired him up with sodium pentothal, you'd find out that he doesn't even believe in the concept of rape, that women are vessels for receiving whatever a man deems via some sort of special relationship with the deity that they should be given.
Right.
And that includes, well, you know, that includes rapists.
Yeah, and I agree, and that's probably right, and you're right. This is probably, in a sense, a totally different, although incredibly barbaric and, you know, regressive and primitive culture that we're, in a sense, confronting. And I didn't mean in any way to trivialize the, you know, the issue in any way, because I, and, you know, and as you rightly said last night, I mean, for any woman that you know or I know or anybody, you know, any woman on the planet, this is very, very, very sick and troubling. But I wanted to tell you also, when I read the article, the other thing that, and of course you've read the whole article, I don't know if other people have as well, but, you know, it points, there's something also terrible about the way that, Amherst College as an institution, in a sense, almost let itself, remain in that kind of barbaric, regressive, culture. And I just wanted to say that, you know, I myself, actually, almost attended Amherst College. I was accepted there, but that was in an era when Amherst College was all male still.
Right.
And in fact, at that time also, and I think they still do though, they also had fraternities. And because of my own values and feelings and sensitivities at the time, the one thing I had vowed is that I would not go to a college that was either all male or had fraternities, because at that time, I found I was very worried about the kinds of, you know, negative or, you know, harmful, I hate to say this, but harmful behavior that happens when you have fraternities on campus or you have a college which is just, you know, boys.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. And that's so, I mean, I know the history of fraternities because I was in one. In fact, when there were fraternities at Amherst, the fraternity of which I joined in college was on campus and, in fact, gave us Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah, okay? Right.
And just to mention for a minute, it's how institutions can be perverted. I mean, I brought forward the story.
That's why I said I didn't want to condemn all fraternities.
No. But I understand. But can you imagine? You know, we had the story about the guy vociferously trying to convince people that he wasn't one of them homos who pours alcohol in his blood.
Yeah, no, that was. I mean, truly bizarre, although fascinating, you know.
Well, my own fraternity was founded on May the 1st, 1848.
Yeah.
By a group of six young men, all of whom had been admitted to Masonry.
Yeah.
And they were a debating society. Yeah. And they discussed, and it's 1848, the great questions of the day are blooming all around them. They're sitting in literally a log cabin in Cannonsburg, Pennsylvania, at what was then Jefferson College.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, they were studying Greek and they were studying Latin, you know, the classical liberal arts education of the day.
Yeah.
And they were discussing matters of great import, and they imbued themselves with, you know, this, well, frankly, a lot of the same silly crap that that the Mormons went on to imbue themselves with, because they lifted the Masonic ritual too.
Yeah.
But it was all about honor, and it was about integrity, and it was about decency, and it was about a quest for knowledge. And how you get from that to butt-chugging?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you are correct. It is, you know, as I said, I hope no one feels that I'm insulting.
Oh, I don't think they do. And I wasn't trying to defend it. I was trying to add a layer of meaning to it.
Yes. Well, you're absolutely right. And I think for, you know, the whole world, the word fraternity, you know, implies, frankly, and particularly when, you know, mostly men went to college, fraternity, you know, does imply something very positive. And, you know, there are certainly people, many, you know, people, both private and public figures who, you know, talk fondly about, you know, the fellowship and the positive aspects of, you know, things that happened in their fraternity. I can think of, you know, people at very different places in life. I can think of the novelist Philip Roth, who, when he was at a small liberal arts college, his fraternity, which was actually sort of the Jewish fraternity, was wonderful. And also the scientist Richard Feynman, who when he was at MIT was, in a sense, kind of, and he went when he was fairly young, you know, sheltered, in a sense, by his fraternity. So there are, you know, certainly very positive fraternity, you know, experiences out there. But you're right, it can be perverted. And I guess when I was applying to colleges, which was in the 70s, I was very worried about, at that time, you know, there was a lot of discussion about fraternity problems, and because I had, as I said, and that was actually the only college I applied to that actually had distinct fraternities. So, and the thing is, Amherst, in some ways, has always been and is a, you know, a very good college. And but I didn't go, and it was in fact in part, well, because it had fraternities, and also because it was all men. But when Amherst went co-ed, which was, I don't know, 15, 20 years later, I thought to myself, gee, wouldn't it have been great if I could have gone, you know, to an Amherst that was co-ed, because I thought that that, and I'll say this, that I thought it would have humanized it, you know, having both men and women together rather than just an all-male college. And, of course, you know, particularly in the 70s, you know, people began to wonder whether all-male colleges were really...
Well, there's something in a society that throws the word democracy around, Harry. There is something unsettling about an all-anything college.
Exactly, yeah. Although, you know, I know that still there are, you know, and I think, you know, they have a right to say this, there are very thoughtful women who still believe that perhaps an all-female college in some cases is in a sense for women a more, you know, a healthier and more accepting environment in which to go to college.
So, well, and you can certainly make that argument out of the Amherst story. I mean, my God, this was, you know,
man, you mean?
You can make the argument that, well, I don't know if you can or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure you can, but I'm just saying I want to recognize also, I know
yeah.
that there are people who will still say that.
But you know, what I'm getting at is that, you know, this is Amherst. This
right.
is not,
well,
this is not Busted Knuckle State.
Well, this is the thing, you know, and if you read if anybody read the whole article, they also know that, you know, in a sense, there was then further information in the newspaper about, the response by the president of this, you know, new co-ed Amherst. And it happens to be a woman. Her name is, I think, Biddy Martin. And what's striking is that it's so odd that the administration, you know, in a sense, found themselves caught, you know, almost unawares by this. I mean, I read her. There was a statement.
Right, because it's almost as if they get up every morning and say, "Look at us. We're Amherst."
Exactly.
Nothing evil may befall us here.
Yeah, and it was an incredible kind of arrogance. And I mean, I've certainly, you know, encountered arrogance at the college that I did go to.
Right, and lest I be taken as suggesting that there's something wrong with Busted Knuckle State, you can even make an argument that maybe Busted Knuckle State would have had a more proactive response to it because it was not cloaked in such a self-awarding sense of privilege.
Yes, I agree, and in fact, in general, I am aware of the fact that in the last 10 years in particular, that many colleges and universities have increased their student services in terms of mental health or, you know, sexual violence, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they've expanded their, you know, counseling centers. They have expanded their, you know, any sort of centers having to do with students in any way, you know, being harmed because of the fact that before that, and that was probably still true in the 70s, maybe even to the 80s, there was not a lot of mental health and other kinds of services available on many university campuses. So, but then there was this push for it. And, you know, and I know that many universities of any, of both kinds, you know, both, both very privileged institutions, but also, you know, big state universities all sort of tried to expand their programs because they were being told they weren't protecting their students enough in a, you know, in a positive way.
But even under the best of circumstances, Harry.
Yeah.
Something else happens. And that is this. Or not something else happens, but there is something underneath anything that a university can do. And I'm sure you've read, that just based on the content of our conversations, you know, you've read the university professors and administrators who bemoan the relative illiteracy of the students they receive from high schools all over the country. You know, they can't read, they can't write, they can't critically analyze text, you know, that kind of stuff.
I haven't. In fact, I just recently read a wonderful book. I don't want to go on about the book, but it's called Doing School, and written by a professor at Stanford School of Education. And what it is about, it's actually about a very privileged public high school. And what's so great about the book is that this woman, Anna, was basically assigned or able to follow around five different students, all of whom were considered by the administration. She let them pick them. Basically the best, you know, students in various ways. And they're not all, you know, just the high-achieving students. They all, you know, there was a
but, range. And I guess what I'm getting at,
yeah,
is this. We not only have kids who are coming ill-prepared academically to institutions of higher learning. You know, the author of the Amherst student piece refers to the brutality of her upbringing before she got to college. At one point, she talks about backwoods. And
that's right. She does, indeed.
And, you know, wow, that word is freighted for somebody like me.
Yeah,
what I'm getting at is we've got kids coming into college. Kids, oh Jesus, I'm old. We've got young people coming into college who have not only been academically ill prepared, but are coming from families that are dysfunction defined, and it doesn't at all. In fact, it may track oppositely. It's not economically derived. Do you see what I know it's easy to do it being this time of year, you know, but think of a young Willard Romney.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, this is
pushing a kid, you know, the administration of Cranbrook had not said a word about that young man's hair. He wasn't violating anybody's code of anything.
Well,
But Bishop Romney decided he didn't like it and drove that young man to the ground and brutalized him.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to tell you that recently a friend of mine who used to be a professor, a very educated person who actually did not grow up in this country, he asked me why it was, though, that the bullying incident, which I believe happened and was documented in April, has not, you know, in a sense, has not been brought up again and again. And I have to agree with them, because to me, that was, to me, the end of my, any respect or any, in a sense, you know, even dignity that I would accord to Bishop Willard was when I read about that. And I have to say that I myself, you know, when I was maybe quite younger in elementary school, was bullied for a period of time by two very specific people. But, you know, so I know what it is like, and I certainly even in college encountered one person who I'd have to say was sort of a subtle, sublime bully in the way that, you know, sophisticated. This was a fairly privileged person. And so I'm even aware of the way that a privileged, you know, person can be a bully, and that, you know, even if it's subtle, and even if the teachers don't always catch it, or if the administration doesn't see it.
Well, I started college at one of those little tiny private liberal arts affairs.
Yeah.
And the one I started at had only become coeducational. Well, they hadn't had their first woman graduate from the college when I started.
Yeah.
I think she was a junior at the time. And, you know, she was put through hell. And a few other women as well. Especially because there was an all girls school a mile away, and
right.
you want to talk about snobbery. The women at the all girls school treated the women who had entered the formerly all male school I went to,
yeah,
like dirt.
Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, wouldn't speak to them.
Yeah, well, that's
I could sit here and tell a story from my freshman year of a privileged young man who was my first roommate.
Yeah.
Who would joyfully tell stories of the hell and damnation that he and his pals had imposed on other young men at some country day school up east.
Yeah. No, it's horrible. We could even take this farther, I guess. This is the way I would talk about it and say, well, you know, let's even remove, in a sense, the privilege and just talk about a person who is, you know, 17 years old or 18 years old, you know, maybe his brain is not totally mature, you know, in terms of
Well, in the case of mine, I can say it wasn't even a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about the research, which shows that brains, I guess.
Yeah, what, 26? Nobody should have a driver's license before age 26?
Right. Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, that's the age now that they're saying. excuse me. sorry.
That's all right.
That judgment, you know, tends to finally kind of, you know, come together. But this is a person, and what he does is he decides, you know, I mean, there's something that, to me, just even if it's in the 50s, very sick about a person of that age who, because he detects a certain kind of, I don't know, a sensitivity or, you know, something that to him seems repugnant because it's not hyper-masculine, that he feels the need, you know, to do something, but to do something incredibly active, you know, and cut off someone's hair. I mean, to me that's barbarism. And I'll say it, you know. So
it is.
When I read about I don't care.
And the failure of anybody to discipline that.
Absolutely. And I don't care if it was the 50s, and I don't care if he was 17. And yet in our culture, I suppose what my friend was asking me, who's not from the United States, was how is it that we're still so coarse that we, you know, that so many people are willing to say, oh, well, he was 17, or, oh, well, it was the 1950s, you know, and we didn't really know a lot about bullying then. My friend was saying, you know, so what? You know, how can it now, so even if things were, you know, coarser then, why is it now that nobody is now pounding on this and saying this man, you know, was a bully? And, you know, and in fact, we can...
Right, and I saw a photograph the other day, and I'm not sure if it was a reenactment based on, or if it was a real photo. It certainly looked like Willard.
Yeah.
But it was something published over at, I believe, Vanity Fair. And I really couldn't get the gist of it, but apparently there's an account out there of Willard with a fishing pole with a $100 bill on it. You know, transparent line and everything.
Yes, sure.
And it's a photo shot of a sort of bedraggled-looking individual in between buildings reaching for the $100 bill, and either Willard or someone who looks a lot like him getting ready to jerk it back with a big old grin on his face like a fox eating poop out of a wire brush. Mm-hmm. And really? And this, I guess it, I don't know, Harry, is this acceptable in the 1% communities? I mean, because we've got the same kind of stories about George W. Bush.
That's right, we do. And we, you know, you mentioned that once several weeks ago.
You know, the brutality with the frogs.
Right. And, you know, this book, Bush on the Couch, which was written by a very, you know, credible psychiatrist, in fact, here in Washington, D.C. you know, I don't know. But see, what struck me was my friend, the one who didn't grow up in the United States, he asked this, he said this to me, frankly, it was after maybe it was a third debate. He basically said to me, well, now it's clear to me, you know, that, or, you know, Romney is such a bully. And, of course, he was talking about the debate. And then we were talking about, you know, also this incident back in, you know, the April, revealing of what Romney did in his prep school. And you realize, in a sense, at least to me, you know, there's a pattern there. And so, you know, then we say, well, why aren't more people even just connecting the dots, you know? I mean, even if you say, okay, it happened once when he was 17, why isn't there more connecting of dots saying, well, didn't he look that same way in that third or second debate? And I'm saying that rhetorically, you know.
Yeah.
And that, I guess, is what bothered me. And I can understand your outrage about, you know, culture and then talking about this island, you know, off of Greece that where a community, you know, is so precious and keeps you know, brings civility because of it. And I certainly myself, you know, have bemoaned, you know, lack of community. And certainly like a place like D.C., I'm sorry to say that even though it's a small, the residential part of the city is relative.
Well, you've got a better chance of experiencing community if you go down to Ben's Chili Bowl than you do if you go up into one of those hoity-toity restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, say up in, well, up in anywhere.
Right, and we should explain that Ben's Chili Bowl is an icon of an African-American restaurant and place to...
Yeah, I've been in there a handful of times, and every time it's not like I'm known, but every time I walk in there, it's, hey, man, how you doing? What do you want?
Right, and no, indeed, in fact, I think you know, people talk about the racial divide in D.C., but I'm quite willing. Seems to me that part of it really, though, is an attempt to maintain community. And
well, you know, I guess it's just a matter of me. I know my class.
Yeah.
Because I'm more concerned with class than racial divides. And I've had a lot better experiences within my class than outside it there, if that makes any sense at all.
Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's right. But what I was saying was that, you know, I mean, you do have, unfortunately, people of other ethnic groups or white people, you know, complaining about the so-called hostility of African Americans in D.C. to them. But you see, I think that part of it really is the African American community, you know, with their history.
Hanging on for dear life.
Absolutely. Hanging on and also wanting to, whatever they can, you know, keep of community, which for them means people who they, you know, feel comfortable with or feel that, you know what they're talking about. They want to hang on to that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Brilliant conversation, Harry. Thank you very much. You got fan mail. Kate just wrote in. Subject line, we don't bore easily. She said, please, Harry, don't presume that whatever informed dialogue you share would ever bore the Horn family. Some nights here are equal to graduate seminars. Others are like overhearing babble in a gas station bathroom. And everything in between. It is never boring here. That's why we keep sending in our dimes and nickels to keep the mic hot. We never know what's going to happen next. Welcome to the family, dysfunctional as it may seem sometimes.
Well, I know Kate is a real veteran of this show, and I take that as a high compliment. I'm quite honored. But, yeah, if you have other callers, I do want to let you go. But I just did want to, in a sense, honor you and also say that I can well understand your outrage about all these different recent issues. I think it's a very scary time in our culture, and it is frankly very comforting to me to frankly hear you talk about it, because then I feel that I'm not so alone in my terror, and I'm sure and I suspect.
Yeah, the one thing that scares me, Harry, is that anyone would perceive, and I think it's more a function of the way I judge myself. Because that judgment is ongoing and constant. You know, I've joked about the nights when you get done with the show and you go, woohoo, that's one for the ages.
Right.
And the other nights when you just curl up in a fetal ball in the corner and suck your thumb. I joke about that, but there's an element of truth to it. And, you know, we talk about community and we talk about, you know, family and conversation and dialogue. And I don't ever want to be one of those people who says, you know, I've got mine, screw you. And I've never experienced anybody in the Horn family like that. And I guess the broader question is, and we go back and forth. I know I do. I despair of the American people quite routinely. You know, that 7% of America who is absolutely convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald shot John Kennedy. I mean, that Lee Harvey Oswald shot Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, what do you do? But then, you know, there's so much decency and there's so much kind concern and there's real seeking that takes place here. And I just wonder why it can't extend.
Well, you may be, you know, you may end up being the person that we look back on and say, well, Bob Kincaid did that. He helped to extend it. You know, as I said, you may, you know, indeed be a pioneer of something that really will become something, you know, very fruitful and very positive. Because I know that you are pained, and certainly I am pained about, you know, these what I consider to be quite dark times, but you know, as I said, I try to make sure that I listen to your show, you know, every night if I can, because it's like a little, you know, it's like that little lamp or that little small fire in the woods that I, you know, makes me feel just a little bit better.
Well, I thank you. I thank you, Harry. And you have yourself a wonderful evening.
Yeah, I'll let you go. Thank you.
Take care. Bye now. Calling from D.C., that is our buddy Harry. And from one conversation to the next, I think Kate said it better than anybody ever has. Sometimes it's like a graduate seminar, and sometimes it's like overhearing battle in a gas station bathroom. And it's all, and it strikes me that it's all worthwhile. I hope I didn't put anybody off with, you know, 2 hours of filibuster tonight. I was just really moved by that article, you know, beyond the, you know, how do I live to be 104? The question of, you know, how we enjoy whatever time is here. By the way, a follow-up from Kate. She said, by the way, Bob, there are women out here who could teach a youngster how to build a cabin, how to tear down a Chevy engine, how to put up a garden, and how to saddle break a giddy pony. It's all about the leather tool pouches and nice fitting jeans. And I know she's right. And I was trying not to get myself in trouble. There are guys who can teach people to quilt. I, for one, was taught to needlepoint because my sister was having to teach it to other students. So I learned to needlepoint, and she's an art teacher, and she had to teach students how to do batik back in the 70s. And I learned how to do batik, and I learned how to make candles. I'm not completely dualist. I just can't rebuild that goddamn Chevy engine. But Kate closes saying, Mad Max times are right over the hill. Be nice to your neighbors. Hear, hear. Aw, damn. It's time to get out of here. Well, this is one of those where does the time go moments. Thanks to all of you. My God, that's the biggest spider I've seen in years. Crawling right across the studio wall. I'm gonna please stay put, would you? I'll take you outside. The hunting's much better. My daughters would scream. Well, for that matter, so would my son. Okay, I gotta deal with this. Just stay put, please. Thanks everybody for everything that you do to make all of this happen. Thank you for helping us reach our fundraising goal for the month of October and beating the Swede. Pursuant to your direction of last month, we will continue to try to raise money. Pursuant to what Tom said in his email, we'll try to build that cushion. Because there's lots of stuff needs doing. And we would actually like to catch up before we even start thinking about getting ahead. I ask you to stay put. Thanks to all the all-volunteer crew who keeps all of this rolling along. Thanks to our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to Agnes. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to John Fox. And thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. He'll get the podcasting up just as quick as the machine gets fixed. Thanks, of course, go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at